Well, the world is a dumpster fire. Nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good. And you're paralyzed with greed. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard, and we got a really good one this week, folks. We have got Ben Roy. You might know him from his vacation rock band, Spells. You might also know him from True TV's Those Who Can't. But you probably know him as a stand-up comedian, and if you don't, you should get to know him. And this is a really good opportunity for you to do that, because we really get into everything here. By the end of this episode, I think you're going to feel like he's your best friend. Now, the conversation does take some really big twists and turns. We go literally everywhere. But that's because Ben is fearless, and he almost wears his fearlessness like a defense mechanism. You know what I mean? Like, he's such an open book. He's willing to tell you literally anything. It's almost intimidating in a way. It's a great conversation. I hope you have a good time with it. Now, I do have to let you know right up front that if you're following him in the news right now, you're aware that he's decided to go public with what happened to him at Catholic summer camp. If you are a person who is triggered by abuse of any kind, this might be something that you want to brace yourself for. We do get into it a little bit in this podcast because we get into a lot of things. We go all over the place. So if you're a person who hasn't dealt with issues like that, or even if you're a person who has, I just know that some of that's coming. Now, this podcast is not designed to be any sort of a replacement for real therapy if you need it. I'm certainly here if you need me. But this is more like test driving a scooter and the owner is riding on the back. You know, it's kind of fun, but maybe not as comfortable as you would like. So just know that going into this. Now, I'm not going to say anything else. This conversation's amazing. We'll get into all the stuff where you can find Ben Roy at the end. But for now, let's just talk to Ben Roy.
But it's, yeah, I have this fucking, I like my stomach, I killed all the bacteria in my stomach.
Oh no.
By taking an antibiotic for an ear infection. So I got SIBO.
Holy shit.
So now I like, my stomach gets upset if I eat like grains. I've lost a bunch of weight really quickly because of it. It's kind of good, like... But, it is a healthier way to eat, to just eat fruits and vegetables and nuts and protein, and that's it.
Yeah. You know?
And this, but, like, these things are the weirdest texture. They're, like, you can't even get the fucking wrapper off it.
It's like glue.
Yeah, because it's, like, connective tissue and fat and stuff like that, plus fruits and...
It's all just nuts and fruits.
And collagen.
And collagen.
Don't okay. They suck that out of people's asses and stuff like that?
Yeah, they put it in your lips.
Yeah, or it's proteins. Yeah. Well, my lips are looking pretty full, aren't they?
Yeah, they look.
They're pouty. Supple. They're poutier.
Yeah, exactly. I got a camera over there. If you don't mind doing some tasteful nudes,
I prefer distasteful nudes. I only work. I only do distasteful nudes.
Perfect.
Okay, so what is the, what's the format of this?
This is it. We're doing it.
Okay.
The format of this is we have a conversation, and I steer it in directions as I see fit.
Okay.
And that's it.
Okay.
That is 100% it. It's typically in and around the neighborhood of mental illness, depression.
Okay.
And it takes, you know, peaks and valleys, but I like it to be just kind of a conversation, and I have areas that we can go in and go out of, and, you know.
I'll let you lead as far as, like, where we start or wherever, but.
Yeah, it's just super loose. The whole thing is just a complete conversation. It's not an interrogation of any kind. I always write down a whole bunch of questions of things I want to know, and then I don't use them.
I talk a lot, so.
Perfect.
But I like it. I mean, a conversation about mental health is good and important. Yeah. All right. Cool. Let's do it.
Yeah. So how was the show last night?
Oh, it was amazing. They're, like, sold out and...
Well, definitely sold out.
Yeah. And it was just... It was great. It was good to be back, you know, in Denver. And just... I was nervous about recording this one because it was the first one I've done that was one and done. Mm-hmm. So I've never, the other two albums I had done, I did over a few nights, but this was the first one, you know, and then I do them like two or three nights and then edit the, you know, the best stuff together. This one I wanted to feel more raw and kind of, like a live, just like a live show of mine. And so I just did it, and I was really nervous. Like, you know, I wanted to get all these bits out. And so
it's... Well, because I got those first two records, and they seem pretty seamless.
Oh, thanks, man. I mean, I got Demons, like, it's funny. I listen to them now, and I guess it's a good thing because I kind of cringe a little bit. You know, I mean, we're always evolving and thinking differently about ourselves and about our craft and... And so, yeah. And then the second one was just real dark.
Yeah.
I think I was in a particularly dark place and I was writing from that. And this one I think is, you know, more kind of over those last few years since I released No Enlightenment and Sobriety that they're like... more of like my, like a, where, what I've been doing comedically for a while, you know, more probably my normal personality.
Yeah.
Now.
Because that second one definitely felt like it was a real amped up black coffee. Like,
yeah. I remember my management was like, I don't think this should be people's first introduction to you, you know, cause it was just real. but I mean, I think anybody in like when you're creating art or you're, you know, producing anything, you know, you go through evolutions and stages and it should be representative of where you're at. And so, yeah, I'm pumped about this new one and it'll be really, I had a good time doing it and the crowd was great and it feels there's parts that are serious and then there are just a lot of like quirkiness and
yeah,
because like, you know, just how I normally am in real life probably.
Well, and this was what the downtown Larimer.
Yeah I mean, we had talked, I'm putting it out with this company called 800 Pound Gorilla Records out of Nashville. They've been awesome, and we had talked about different clubs that I may be interested in approaching to try to record at, but ultimately, I told him, I was like, I mean, you're not going to get better sound than the Comedy Works in Denver. I know that, you know, the crowds are going to be awesome. So it worked out very well. And I think the sound is going to be exactly what you want on a live recording. And
yeah,
so, but that's my home. And Wendy has been amazing. And I live in LA right now, but, you know, Denver is always my home. I'm here all the time just because this is where I would rather be right now.
Yeah. Well, LA is interesting. It's, I mean, it was because I was just there last week.
And, oh, cool. And what were you doing?
Just vacationing.
Yeah.
Just took the family on our first vacation ever.
Oh, really?
You know, so
you went to LA?
I mean, we went to Universal Studios.
Oh, yeah. And did the beach and stuff like
that. Yeah, exactly. Skateboarded on Venice Beach and all
that.
Oh,
yeah. So it's cool. It's
fucking awesome.
Yeah.
I had been there through there with, you know, punk bands and shit years ago. And so, like, I had always kind of rolled through. But, you know, when you roll through somewhere, it's not the same thing.
Yeah. So, especially when you're playing shows.
Yeah, because it's just venue, van.
Yeah.
And then, you know, maybe a hotel, maybe someone's house, yeah, maybe the van.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then that was my whole experience with traveling everywhere. Like even coming to Denver. And then, I was in this band for like 10 years.
Yeah. And what was the band?
It was, we were called the Banana Convention.
Okay.
We were sort of a No Doubt kind of thing. We had a female front woman
who
had
cool
pipes on her. And, we just played sort of, you know, pop punk,
sky pop kinda punk.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it was really fun. It was a real good time. Got to see a lot of places doing it. House of Blues in Chicago, shit like that. It was really cool. But then, you know, the last year after we've been doing it 10 years, you know, I was like, well, I'm over 30 now, man. So like, you know, it's got to happen or it's not going to happen because there's rules.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, just thinking there's these gatekeepers out there.
Yeah.
And so on our last tour that we did, we put stops between shows. It wasn't a show every night. It was a show like every 3-4 days. So we treated it like a show vacation kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I finally got to see some places.
Oh, that's
awesome. That was when it clicked for me. And I was like, I got to get the fuck out of Michigan because this sucks.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm tired.
Where in Michigan are you from?
I was in Saginaw. It was this little place like 2 hours out of Detroit. Like,
yep.
I was chasing crackheads out of my house and, you know, you'd call the police and they wouldn't show up and things like that. So it was kind of a fucked up little neighborhood.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'll be unemployed, but I'm going somewhere.
How long ago did you move here now?
Like 6 years.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. This is just a great place. I lived in Michigan for a short time. I lived outside of Ann Arbor.
Nice. And yeah. See, that's kind of a cool area.
Yeah. Well, I lived closer to Jackson, but, and then we just kind of bounced around the state. We had, a friend of mine was going to Central in Mount Pleasant. So
yeah.
My buddy and I tried to make it work living out there, and it was just too expensive to live in any area that you really wanted to live in. But
right,
Ypsilanti and Ann Arbor were really awesome. That whole area is really cool.
Yeah,
and so much good music came out of Michigan's music scene, even like still continuing to. You know, I mean, I think it's just because it's so gritty and it's got such a great history of music.
Yeah,
you know, from those 50s on. So
I got a couple of friends who are still back there, you know, banging it out, fighting the good fight, and they just putting out records and like really, really solid shit, like really good stuff. So yeah, I think that there's definitely an element of adversity telling you something about yourself.
Yeah.
And then you make a decision. What am I going to do with this?
Yeah.
And a lot of people make art out of it and they make really good art.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, 601, like I haven't written nearly as many songs since moving here as I did when I was chasing people out of my house.
Yeah. Yeah. Happiness isn't really all that good sometimes for creativity.
Yeah. You have to learn how to, not be a slave to your moods.
Yeah.
Because if you're a slave to your moods, you'll never get anything done.
Right.
Because if you're not in the mood to do something, then you're not going to write. But, you know,
it's definitely about harnessing a certain power and darkness or whatever. I try, you know, like, I mean, but I will say I'm equally sometimes as unproductive when I'm depressed and anxious, you know, or whatever. There's a malaise or a torpor that kind of just comes over, and getting anything done is really hard, you know? Yeah. So, I'd say I produce a lot when I feel energetic, but there's always been I don't know, for most of my life, I think I've always had this kind of, uneasiness. I don't know. I don't know why. I mean, I'm, you know, I'm just,
where do you think that comes from? Like what, when you say uneasiness, what are you talking about?
I mean, I think growing up where I did was just, I grew up in Maine in a really economically depressed area that, I lived in Nashua, New Hampshire till I was 8. And then we moved back to Maine where my parents were from. And I lived in a little town called Winthrop, which is in central Maine. And it's poor, you know, there's not a lot of money. And, at that time, even at that time, when I was in middle school and when I got into high school, opioids were already big. I mean, the heroin problem was huge, and it was a problem in my school. Our school only had 270 kids.
Jesus.
So I come from a town of 5,000 people, but, you know, I mean, depression and mental illness was just there's an isolation out there that I think small towns oftentimes breed a fear of the rest of the world around you, and it starts to make everything feel very small and hopeless. And when everybody knows you, you get trapped into roles really easy. It's really hard to change when you're in a small town.
Yeah.
And I think that creates a lot of anxiety and a lot of depression, a feeling that the ceiling is very low for everybody. And, that struggling will just kind of be a part of your landscape for the rest of your life, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that growing up there was a part of it. Everybody's great. Don't get me wrong. But I mean, there just, our school had a lot of problems with drugs. I mean, my school, Winthrop High School, if you look it up, was in Sports Illustrated. They did a story because like 5 or 6 football players committed suicide in like 2 years.
Jesus Christ.
I mean, it was very, I have a lot of friends that I've lost who have taken their own lives, and I succumbed to depression and anxiety. Like too many. You know, I mean, and I think it was because that, that's how I found music. You know, I didn't get into comedy till later on in life, till I was 24. But I've been playing in bands since I was 15 years old, you know, and because that was my outlet. I was so unhappy. So I think that plays a part of it. Also, I've been more vocal about it now, you know, but when I was young, I was sexually assaulted at a Catholic summer camp, and I think that set into motion some things within myself that definitely some anxiety and behavior patterns that ultimately shaped who I am today. You know, I mean, and so there, I think there's any number of things. It was just a wrong place, right time, you know, type thing. My parents are great people, but the people that I chose to be around, I think Maine is a toxic place for some people because it's so hyper masculine.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
the
Northeast is for that.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And rural areas are in general. And I think, you know, like when the Spotlight article came out, and I've said this a bunch of times, I probably sound like a broken record, but, you know, there was this a lot of talk of like, you know, how could this happen? How could this have, you know, how could all these priests have done this?
Yeah.
You know, and why didn't anybody speak up? Why didn't these kids talk? You know, it must have been kids talked. Yeah. I talked. I told my parents.
But I mean, are you fucking kidding me? Like, why didn't these kids talk? I mean,
no, but it's also like, but it's also, there are people who didn't talk, but there are a lot of kids who did. And there are a lot of kids who told their parents. I told my parents.
Yep.
Nothing was done. And it's because, one, the Catholic Church exerted a lot of power in the French Canadian, like Franco-American community, which a lot of the Northeast is.
Yeah.
And also there's a lot of homophobia.
Yeah.
I grew up around people who were homophobic. I definitely was. Masculinity is currency in New England.
Yeah.
And so
exactly.
And at that time, being gay was the antithesis of being masculine. And so it was like, if anybody found out, you know, that I had been a part of something, then they would have, I would have been ridiculed.
Yeah.
No one would have ever let me get a, I mean, being called a faggot, I was already being called a faggot.
Well, you would have got your fucking ass kicked.
Yeah, like, because people... I was a skater and, you know, and so I met these kids that I thought were tough and that I wanted to be around. And because of that, I think I attached myself to troubled people because I felt like there was some safety in that. And also they were fucked up like I was, you know, so
let's stick together. Or yeah. Else yeah. Yeah. Killed.
And I think that's why I liked punk rock, you know, yeah. It was like, every weekend was an island of misfit toys, you know,
yeah.
Like,
oh my God, the fucking all ages shows.
Oh, like, they were just so fucking good. I mean, there was a kid with schizophrenia hanging out with you. You know what I mean? And like,
yeah,
there was like trans people and gay people and just like fucking straight up fuck ups and skateboarders. And it was like in Maine, it was like anybody who didn't want to be a redneck, you know?
Yeah.
And like didn't want to be considered a hick. You know, if you snowboarded, you skated, you listened to punk rock, you were any bit of counterculture, you were in the punk rock scene. And like, yeah. So there was just this weird mix of people, and I liked that. It felt like acceptance, but unfortunately with a lot of them were troubled, and there was a lot of violence, and there was a lot of I learned to drink and, you know, problematically early on, and started smoking pot at 12 or 13, and you know, like the warning signs I think were there for my parents, but I don't think back then people knew what to look for.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't in everybody's face like it is now.
Sure.
You know?
Well, and how do you tell your parents, you know, everything that you're going through when, you know, as a teenager, you don't even really know what you're going through.
Yeah.
You just know that getting fucked up puts all those things over there for a while.
Yeah. It felt, and even you didn't even have a word for it. It just took away this torpor is a good word for it. This just feeling of like, nothing is good and it's everything's fucking boring. And like, those are the early onset signs of depression. And so I would just like I started smoking pot cause it was fun.
Yeah.
You know, that was what was fun. It made me feel good. And then I started drinking because it took away my anxiety. It made me less anxious. I felt less anxious talking to people and I felt less out of place. And I think people would probably be, I mean, shocked maybe in high school. Cause I was kind of, I was social with everybody, you know, I've always been very social, but I felt very uneasy. And I mean, I had my first panic attack, I think at 15 or 16 years old. I ran out of a class and ran home. I actually ran from my school all the way home. And I didn't go back to school for a few days because I was so messed up from it. And I still count that as probably the most defining moment of who I've been afraid of panic attacks ever since that day, 22 years ago or whatever, 23 years ago. I think I probably only had about 10 real panic attacks in my entire life.
That's
but
enough.
The rest of the time is living in fear of them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, the rest of the time is this anxiety of when it's going to happen and I'm going to make a fool out of myself. And so, the growing up was in that environment was hard. It was just a hard place because you were ridiculed if you were different and you were ridiculed if you were viewed as weak and you were ridiculed for pretty much anything. And so I hid a lot of who I was, and that anytime you do that, that just creates a self-loathing and depression and anxiety that is very hard to shake, that I'm still trying to work through now, you know,
yeah.
At 39 years old. So,
well, when someone takes away, your lock on the universe where you've got control over things, you've certainly got control over yourself.
Yep.
And then someone takes that away from you and says, guess what? Things can happen to you that you don't want.
Yeah.
And that happens to you. You start building defense mechanisms.
Yeah.
In order to get through your daily life, because now you're on defense all the time because you never know what the fuck is going to be coming at you.
The weirdest part too is that it happened. I mean, I remember vividly things happening, and I remember some things that started and didn't, and I was writing about it, and I was thinking, like, I had heard this story about, like, the color blue. There wasn't a word for the color blue up until in modern literature. That it's relatively new, and it was on Radiolab. I was listening, and they were talking about how these researchers went down and found these isolated Amazonian tribes, and they would show them something with the color blue on it, and they couldn't see it. They could not see the color blue. Their rods and cones in their eyes have the ability to perceive it, but they had no need to, because the color blue doesn't exist in their natural environment. And I know people are saying, like, well, what about the sky? But I had that question. They had an explanation for it, but
sure.
But these tribes couldn't see it, and they had to be shown it over and over again and explained it, and then all of a sudden the color is there, and now they can perceive this color that hadn't had any use to them before.
Yeah,
that was similar. Like, this happened, and I don't remember pain, like, or feeling anything other than, like, that it was awkward. But I don't remember any depression coming from. As soon as my parents had removed me from the camp, I remember feeling better, but it was always in the back of my head.
Yeah.
And then when I was explained it enough and shown it enough, the pain was just there.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, the anger and the pain was just there. My ability to perceive what had happened, I hadn't needed it before. There's no word. No 7-year-old kid needs a word for what all that is. It doesn't need that. It's not a part of their function yet. So there's just no word in their library. There's no word in their perceptions for it yet. Unless you find people who have it rampant and systemic in their household and they learn to, but like where mine was isolated to a week long at camp or what have you.
Yeah.
And then I was pulled from that. I didn't have it until, you know, I was older, and I think I was 10 or 11 when I told my parents part of it. And then I remember their reaction, and for reasons that I've forgiven them for, and I understand now, they didn't do anything about it.
Yeah.
But that set more into motion than anything else. That shaped more of who I am now. I think the action shaped something, but had that been handled correctly, I probably would have not dealt with some of it. I think feeling like I wasn't listened to or protected set a lot more of my mental health issues into motion. And yeah. I think that that's something that parents need to realize, is that you can do equally as much damage as the victimizer by just simply not giving credo to what it is they're saying.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, like that feeling. It, just giving a child, I think we're dealing with the Me Too movement right now, that just simply by not listening and not giving people the chance to, like, be vocalized and to say, like, this really affected you, re-victimizes a person, you know, in an odd way. It, like, creates different issues within them. And so I think that set about this need to, like, part probably why I'm loud and why I'm aggressive is like this. I always have this need to be heard. Like, and then when I would get drunk, when I drank, it would be like, you're not fucking listening to me.
Yeah.
You know, people would be like, I am listening. No, you're fucking not. You know, like, real anger came from behind it. Like, and I remember that feeling of, like, in my teens, of, like, real anger, the kind of anger that scares you, you know, like, and
that kind where you just see red.
Yeah.
Like, you literally just see red.
Yeah. And I'm willing to burn everything to the ground. Like, I don't care about, you know, like,
it's riot going mentality.
For it. Yeah.
It's like, we're going to fuck this up right now.
Yeah.
And then we'll deal with it tomorrow.
I don't care anymore. Yeah. Like, I'm willing to throw everything away just to give this emotion its voice.
Yeah.
Like, to let it out and be heard. It's not healthy, you know? I mean, it's a terrible way to live your life. And so I think a lot of anxiety and depression was shaped. That's a super, super long answer, but there's just a lot of pieces. I think it was part environment, part circumstances, and part family dynamics that kind of, I mean, I think that that's what shapes all of us. I mean, it's yeah. a, you know.
I mean, we're all a construct of various pieces.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but again, thinking back about your parents even, like what were their options even? I mean, if you think about them as yeah. the people that they were in the town that they were in, you know, and especially one of those small towns in fucking Maine when snowstorms, you want to talk about isolation. I mean,
yeah, it's, you know, I liken it, my parents' reactions to people in 9/11 on those planes, you know, like there's a lot of people now that are like, what the fuck, you know, like don't believe that people actually flew planes into buildings because why wouldn't they did it with box cutters? Yeah, they did.
Yeah.
Because everybody prior to that date had never heard of anybody doing anything. It wasn't in the news that anybody would fly a plane into a building
yeah.
and use it as a missile. Prior to that, everybody had been conditioned to sit and behave because they were used as ransom. That's yes. what you'd been told.
Yeah.
That's what you'd been told. So now that we know it, you see people, anybody stands up quickly, they get dropped by the passenger next to them. You yeah. know what I mean? We're all ready. If somebody stands up with a box cutter on a plane, you're going to get fucked up. Like this, you're yeah. going to be drawn and quartered by a bunch of tourists from Milwaukee. You know what I yeah. mean? They're going to kill you on this plane.
Yeah.
And that's the difference. We're now conditioned. We're now aware.
Right.
There was the same thing in the 90s and the early 90s when I came out to my parents and told them this. There wasn't, the word pedophilia didn't even come out. It didn't become part of normal lexicon until the 90s.
Yeah.
Prior to that, there just wasn't a word. And things like that happened, I think, in my parents' culture. And you were conditioned to not talk about it.
Right. It was the neighborhood weirdo.
Yeah.
And that was it. That was all.
And that was it. You know, like, shit happened. But then people started to say, like, okay, like, this now psychologists and psychiatrists started coming forward and being like, this has a profound effect on human sexuality, the like self-image, self-worth. Mm-hmm. It has family dynamics. It shapes them for generations. This is dangerous.
Yeah.
And we need to start having a conversation about this and like, you know, going after perpetrators, not just moving them around away from people.
Yeah.
And I think that that's the difference. My parents just did not know how to react. They didn't know the warning signs. They didn't know that kids will often laugh when they bring it up. Because mm-hmm. I said something jokingly. And then they said, well, that's not funny. And I was like, well, that is true part. I didn't tell them everything. I told them part of it.
Yeah.
And they now we know as a culture that that's how kids process things. And we're taught right. that if you hear anything to take it seriously,
yeah.
but they weren't given that, you know? And so my parents, it was like, they were frozen as a lot of parents were back then.
They couldn't see the color blue.
Right. Exactly. There was no word for it.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. I think that there was a ton of fear of the Catholic Church. And I think there were, unfortunately, it created a lot of victims. We lie on the cusp of that. Our generation lies on a hinge of change, you know? There were yeah. the people before who dealt with it in silence and didn't talk about it. And then there were the people that are now generation afterwards who are much more open about that. And then there's our generation, that generation that lay right on that line of it where,
yeah,
you know, like between childhood and adulthood, the rules changed. And it changed drastically, and I think that was hard for me. I vocalized a lot of anger at my parents, and then as I got older, I have a kid, you know, I mean, I realized it's not an easy job.
Yeah.
It's real easy to point fingers, but sometimes you don't know what the fuck to do, and I realized my parents...
And you react too late.
Yeah.
You know, it's. Yeah. I always say it's not really a matter of if you're going to fuck your kids up. It's how.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because you're going to do something.
Yeah.
That they're going to remember for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
There's just going to be something. You can only hope that the trauma is minimal.
Yeah, it's a weird thing that we have this reciprocal altruistic like tendency in us that we're very selfish creatures. We tend to do a lot of what motivates us are things that benefit us personally.
Yeah.
You know, we're very selfish. Most of everything that comes out of everybody's mouth is self-serving, or it acts as feathers to make themselves seem bigger or more colorful than they are.
Yeah.
When in reality, most of us are just boring and plain and the same as we, you know, and so most of it is just selfish. And then in the middle of all of that, you're tasked with the most selfless task out of all, which is caring for another completely vulnerable, like, yeah, susceptible to everything human life.
Right.
And it's the hardest thing. You have to balance your own selfishness. That was what I realized, is like, there was also a fear of like how my parents would be perceived. My mother is a staunch Catholic. My mother is very Catholic. I grew up in a very Catholic home in New England, and the Irish and the French are extremely Catholic in New England. I mean, there's the Catholic churches, everything. And growing up, my dad, not so much. And especially now and later on in life, he's very agnostic. But, you know, I mean, we went to church every Sunday. I went to Sunday school every, yep, Sunday. I went to Catholic school. And then I went to a Catholic summer camp. I went, yeah, to public school when I moved to Maine. But I went through all of the sacraments up and through I was my confirmation. And then that's when you're allowed to make your own choices. And I never went back to church. But I would say I'm agnostic now. I don't know, and I don't discount anything.
Yeah.
But I never went back to organized church and regular church and things like that. I just never.
Yeah.
After that point.
So yeah, I kind of felt the same way. Like, I don't have anything in place at the moment currently. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The way that I like to phrase it to people is, you know, it's easy for me to say a word like atheist right now. It's, yeah, easy for me to say a word like that. But to me, what that means is right now, I got nothing. But that doesn't mean the door's not open if,
yeah,
something comes my way.
Yeah.
If something comes my way that I can't, you know, put it in a box somewhere.
Yeah.
Obviously, I'm going to change my mind.
Yeah.
That's what any, I think, reasonable person would do.
Yeah. You know, I don't know what I believe. I was mentioning that other thing earlier, too, just all that stuff. That's how powerful a presence the Catholic Church was, yeah, in our home. So, like, standing up to that was hard for my family. And I think going to
Catholicism is super powerful. I mean, there's so much ritual involved.
Yeah.
And it's very attractive.
In small towns, they're community leaders.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They have the ear of anybody who's, you know, I mean, if you're involved, anybody who's in power in small towns and in local government, the priests have the ear of, and vice versa.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of policy and ideas get pushed through the church. They're very powerful people, but it's a human organization, and that's bound to happen. And when you have humans grouped together and you're given power, you have sexuality used as control, mm-hmm, and sex is used as control. And I think that that's just an unfortunate side effect of the human dynamic we're living in right now, this society that we've created. But I look at, like, now what I think, I don't know what I believe we're all connected in some manner. I think, you know, they look at, like, they always say, like, the largest living organism on the planet is a group of aspen trees or what have you. Like,
yeah.
That they're connected by a giant root system. But I think humans probably are. I mean, I think we're all probably linked in some manner through air, through, you know, if you look,
otherwise, how would there be, you know, the levels of, not even just empathy. Empathy is the wrong word for it. But, you know, there is a connection between, I mean, like, even me and you sitting across from each other right now.
Yeah.
That we have right now that we wouldn't have if we were just on the phone.
Right, exactly.
Like, there's something, the space between the molecules, the something.
Yeah, yeah.
There is something.
And if being connected is the ability to pass information or nutrients or things like that, if you think of how viruses and bacteria are handed off collectively through all of us, but not to oftentimes to plants or minerals or,
sure,
or other animal species, if you think about that, That to me tells us that we are connected in some manner. There's a direct link between all of us. Not to mention, like, if you look, it's known. You put human, like, when babies are born, if they don't have human contact, they are sick. They become underweight.
Yeah.
They often find later on in lives they don't have certain immunities. That just our human contact is important to each other. That shows you that there's a very powerful bond between human beings. And it's the reason why I think we've proliferated at the rate that we are, you know? And yeah. I think that that's the closest to religion that I get right now, is the belief in, like, our connection to each other. That we'll discover through some enlightenment or understanding that we are capable of being each other's salvation and each other, like, because we're connected. I love the saying, to speak the name of the dead is to make them live again.
Yeah.
And it's our ability to just even talk about people who have passed on, gives them life in our consciousness and in our memories, that they live on. That those emotions and feelings that when they were around, when you feel that in a group, when you go to a remembrance ceremony or anything like that, this ability to collectively feel the emotion that you felt when that person was around.
Yeah.
Shows that we're connected. We're capable of providing an experience for each other. And that to me that's profound and just as important as some afterlife that, you know, may or may not be there, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that, why is that?
I mean,
that
doesn't it make it very special? I mean, just that alone, just that very idea, the very idea that we have this.
Yeah. You know, what's funny to me is, like, I guess people look at our proliferation on the planet as being something profoundly negative. And I think that that's just an inherent distrust or,
I agree. It's completely neutral.
Yeah.
It's the situation is what we're...
Yeah, like this idea that the Earth gives two shits about what happens, like, it's always designed after our own morality. Like, when parents, when people talk about the Earth, they're like, oh, at some point, Mother Nature is going to kill humans off and put it right back to the way it would. No, no, no. You're assigning morality.
Yeah.
You're saying that we're bad. That's a human construct.
Yeah.
The real reality is that we're nature's greatest achievement. Look at what we've done. We've managed to proliferate at a rate that amongst mammals, insects do it.
But complexity.
Yeah.
Look at the complexity of human beings versus insects.
And to think you're part of this connection. And I do have hope that we're starting to figure things out. You know, as much as people, whether or not you agree with gun control or not, or you, because I don't talk about it a lot. It's too hot button issue. I don't know entirely where I stand right now on it.
And it's hard.
It's very hard. It's hard to say because I grew up in a small town where firearms were in every household.
Sure.
And, I understand arguments on both sides, so I'm not meaning that to get in the middle of it or anything like that. But I think when you – I've totally lost my train of thought. but I think when you look at something as complicated and then you see – oh, what I was going to say is you see what kids did recently.
Yeah.
That they marched – themselves, whether or not you're on the right or the left, kids are becoming passionate about something.
Yeah.
If this may be the first time I look at my son's generation and they're different. There's something different about them. I actually feel, I joke a lot about it that I don't have hope because it's more funny than joke that you have hope. But
there's no comedy in uplifting hope.
Yeah. And that's just good. Not funny. Yeah. You don't need to make the light side of light. You know what I mean? You try to find the light side of dark.
Exactly.
And so, like, at least I do. And there are great comics who find the light-hearted side of the light-hearted things, and or the good or the positive.
Yeah.
But the light is already shining on it. You have to shine the funny on dark stuff. But I look at my son's generation and I feel really, they talk about things more. He talks to me about how he feels. The kids at his school do, you know, and whether or not you think we're too touchy-feely as a culture or whatever, I think more communication is always good, you know, and it's been great for my own mental health issues. You know, I mean, comedy has been, and music is communication, and it's interesting to see how when you write something or you express something, what people say that it does for them on both sides.
Yeah.
I mean, conservative or liberal. I have people who message me that say, like, you talking about your mental health issues, it feels good to hear somebody say that, you know, because they don't feel alone anymore, you know? And I think that that's what happened during my parents' generation.
Yeah.
They felt fucking alone, and they drank their faces off because of it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because the thing that I find causes you to, start impairing yourself is you start looking for ways to have an excuse to let it go.
Yeah.
Because you can't just express your heart, or, you know, you'll get punched in the mouth, faggot. You know, you can't just express your heart. You can't just have an opinion that differs from the people around you or your peer group. You can't just be. You can't.
Yeah.
But when you're fucked up, you got excuses.
Yeah.
You have a box to put yourself in to say, oh, well, that wasn't me. That was this.
Yeah.
And so you can set that aside. But the trick is, once you give that up and now you're sitting with yourself, and it's always been, well, these are the tools I used to get me through situations where I needed to be myself.
Yeah.
Where I needed to be vocal. I needed to be social. I needed to be open to other human beings, both ways.
Yeah.
Outwardly and inwardly. And I don't know how to do that myself because I spent so long learning how to tamp those fucking things down.
I think you're doing a great job at it right now. I mean, what do you mean you don't? You're hosting a podcast about it.
Well, yeah.
You're inviting people over to talk about it. I mean, I think that that's what you should be doing, you know? I mean, I think creating a dialogue is doing something about it. But
you have to have an intention. You know, and that's where it comes from for me. Like, I mean, I have to have an intention behind things, or at least I'm getting a lot better at it. But like, I had severe social anxiety.
Yeah.
Like, my whole life. It was so bad. I couldn't do anything. I mean, even up to, you know, even let's say less than 10 years ago, like, I didn't want to go to the grocery store by myself. Like, I just couldn't. There were a lot of things I just couldn't do. Like, I couldn't be around people, but I couldn't be alone either because I didn't like me either.
Yeah.
So there was this weird dichotomy. So I kind of came up with a solution, which was, I'll be an entertainer because it'll give me a purpose for being places.
Right.
It'll give me a reason to be somewhere.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if I'm attacked or if I'm not wanted, well, I'm here to work. I have to be here.
Yeah.
You know, so that was the weird thing that came out of that.
Yeah, yeah. I think I definitely have that. Like, yeah. I relate to that because I'm not very good in public situations. I think a lot of time, it depends on the side of me you get.
Yeah.
There are people out there who are probably, who I know regret approaching me and saying hi because what they get is this awkward fucking verbal diarrhea where I just talk and talk and talk. And they're like, well, okay, I'm going to go now. I've had so many people like, cause I'm so anxious and I clam up and then I'm like, when I'm nervous, I just talk a lot, you know? And, so I think, I definitely relate that, like, stand up and music was an environment I could control.
Yeah.
It was my ability to control the way in which I was communicating because I felt like in public I couldn't control it. You know, there was a lot of randomness, you know, and the noise and the crowds. I always feel like I can't get out of a space. So I'm like, well, what happened? I'm trapped in here. What happens if I have a panic attack? All these people are going to laugh at me they're going to take video footage of me and put me on YouTube. You know, I'll end up some viral video or something. Or like, I think like, what happens if I need access to help? Like I have a heart attack and no one can get to me because I'm in the middle of this giant crowd. Or
yeah.
I more think about that.
Do you look for exits?
All the time. That's classic agoraphobia.
Yeah.
Like agoraphobia, people think it's a fear of crowd. It's, It's actually a fear of not of a fear that you won't be able to get help or assistance if you needed it.
Yeah.
Or that you'll make a fool out of yourself. And what's funny is I make a fucking fool out of myself for a living. Just the irony of the fact that I'm afraid of making a fool out of myself, and it's caused so much anxiety. But yet I spend so much time being a fucking clown on stage,
yeah,
and poking fun at myself and opening myself up and like dissecting myself that why am I afraid? No one's fucking judged me for that.
Yeah.
But it's because I control the manner in which it comes out.
Yeah, you're making the choice. This is the version of me you're going to get.
Yeah.
This is what that guy is like. I mean, you're creating a persona.
Right.
This is who Ben Roy is.
Right. It's a control over it.
Yeah.
I think humans do a lot of things, and we have everyone a lot does of our, it. Yeah. Lot of our anxiety.
Why the fuck do we have 27 Instagram filters?
Yeah. And Facebook is extremely popular because it allows you a lot of control. Like,
sure.
It gives you a lot of control over what you say about yourself, what you portray to people, the people that you associate with. People are like, well, I block so many people. That's a sign of it. It allows you to control the messages that are coming in and how you feel. And for better or worse, I don't know that that's positive or negative. Yeah. I think one of the worst parts about Facebook is the ability, and Twitter, is the ability to edit your feed.
Sure.
You know, there used to be a time, there was a time where I believe that when the television stations were still largely, there was only a few of them, and they were still largely heavily restricted by the government, you know, and partially owned. There was often a mandate that if you showed one point of view, you had to give the fair and exact same amount of time to the counterpoint of that. And now there's just full channels that play to your one opinion.
Yeah.
And that's not healthy because it closes your world off. And it also makes it so you don't have to figure out a way to coexist with other fucking people.
Bingo.
And yeah. I think that creates an isolationism.
It's gone very tribal.
Yeah.
Really tribal.
And that's bad.
It is.
And I think people forget that isolation is bad on every level. If you look at genetic level, people who are racial purists are such fucking assholes. Like, how many more times does science have to tell you that racial purity is bad? It is a bad idea on a genetic on biological level. If we do not mix amongst each other, you do not trade immunities.
Yeah.
You fucking idiots. It's the reason that most Native Americans were wiped out before anybody had ever actually colonized North America. Like, two-thirds of the native population was killed by smallpox just because people stepped foot, because they were a completely isolated group of people.
Yeah.
And so when you isolate groups of individuals, they don't trade information. It is bad. It's bad for intelligence. It's bad for biology and for our health. It's bad in every manner.
It's bad for culture.
Right. It's bad to culturally isolate yourself. The fact is, there are fucked up people. There are liberal people. There are psychotics. There are always going to be that when you have a system like this, when we create one that values money and fame and things the way it does.
Yeah.
We're going to have these people. So you got to choose. If you want to continue down this road, you have to understand that there, part of that comes with just this plethora of different types of people and opinions and views, because that's how you stand out.
Yeah.
Because that's how you protect yourselves. That's the dynamic. We group, you know?
Yeah.
And
that's fine. Finding your group, finding your people, that's all fine. All of those things are good, and they can be overwhelmingly positive. The issue is when you start otherizing. Everybody who's other than you is part of the problem. They're part of the enemy. It's like there are certain lines that you can draw in the sand. They just shouldn't be so close together.
I think now I have friends with, I mean, it pisses people off. They're like, dude, some of your friends are fucked up. And I, You know, do they believe? And I'll be, yeah, I grew up with them.
Yeah.
I know that person and they're not what you think they are.
Yeah.
I hate to tell people what you see on social media is not that person.
Yeah.
We weren't given, you know, a brightly colored chin flap to display to a mate. You know what I mean? Or yeah. We weren't given these.
Sure.
Peacock level plumes. What we were given was language, and language makes us seem interesting. We use it to self-aggrandize and to glorify ourselves and to make ourselves seem like something we're not.
Yeah.
Or to cement ourselves in our little groups even more, you know? And so it's like, half the time when I read shit, I just laugh at people.
Yeah.
Because I'll just be like, you don't really fucking believe that. I know you, dude. Like, yeah. I know you would give the shirt off your back. If you saw somebody fucking suffering, you would not sit and watch that. But on Facebook, you will say that you will. You'll talk shit about anybody. You know what I mean? And that's my thing. Is it's like, it's the same. Like, right now, this rhetoric is so fucking dialed up. And I see people posting, like, getting more and more heated. And I'm like, I know you've never been in a fight your entire life.
Yeah.
You're doughy. And that's okay.
Yeah.
But you're a doughy person. You're not ready for violence.
Right.
I train every day. When I'm home in LA, 5 days a week, I take jiu-jitsu. I go to jiu-jitsu a lot.
Yeah.
2 hours a day. I train for violence. I don't want to ever be in a fight. I don't ever want to see another fight. Like, I've been taking martial arts on and off for that long, and I know violence it's fucking terrible, and most people are not prepared for it. They may be prepared physically, but you're not prepared for the instinctual feeling of watching one of your own species, where it doesn't matter what color, what gender, what sexual orientation, you're not prepared to watch them twitch on the ground, to watch their hands lock up because they hit the head on their pavement. You feel guilt for that. You feel empathy and sympathy just because you supposedly disagree on the means to find happiness. You're not ready for that.
Yeah.
You don't want that. If there's a way to go around that, I think we should figure that out right now. And I think that the violent rhetoric on both sides, people are going to find a quick distaste for it if it reaches that level. I also think it's noisy.
It's just noisy.
It's just noise.
But that's also what our kids have right. You were talking about seeing something different in your kid than you see out in the world. And that's because the kids grew up with the internet.
Yeah.
They grew up with it. So they treat it like the tool that it is, just like we grew up with a television and we're not in love with it. You know what I mean? But it's our parents and the older people and the people that age. And people our age, even, who didn't grow up with the internet, saw it come into being, and now we don't know how to integrate it. We don't know how to manage it.
Yeah,
and so it's grown-ups and adults that are getting fucked up by all this. When kids, they get it. They know it's not real life.
We were talking about this too, like texting, their language, like. So many people are like, the written language is dying these days. You look at how people spell things and whatnot, or the lexicon that they've created in text and whatnot. I think it's interesting.
Yeah.
What they've done is they've evolved language. People forget the written language, writing and reading is very new in the span of human evolution.
Yeah.
This is a very new construct. And for most evolutionary biologists and psychologists agree, it probably serves very little function other than as a way to meet people, as part of our sexual evolution, was a way to bond and to show yourself as interesting and to convey information.
When I make this noise, you get wet.
Yeah. I do. I look at it and I'm like, they're refining and evolving the language to get information out so much quicker. The fact that it would take a sentence to say, to convey or to a specific emotion. And then like, I'll look at Milo and I'll be like, what do you think by that? And they'll be like, it's just an emoji. Oh, well, they're mad at me. Why? Because of how they sent it. And I'll be like, you've literally put it into a symbol. Like that's an evolution of it. They're refining it faster, quicker, and more succinct.
Sure.
And that's what humans do. We find the way to make things easier and quicker. How do we do this faster?
Yeah.
And the easiest way possible. And I think it's an interesting, I think it's an interesting thing. I mean, what they're doing, I look at like, I'm trying to have hope for it.
Yeah.
I look at my son's school and it's extremely diverse and they don't, I went to this film thing and there was so many different viewpoints in this film festival at his school expressed. It was mind-blowing. I was like, where I went to school, if anybody had made a video like this, people would have been like, what the fuck? Are you fucking serious right now? What? We've lost our fucking minds. We've lost our minds. What kind of flower bullshit is this? But they don't, I mean, they're just different. They still have problems. There's always going to be problems. But I think they're not going to be as plagued by some of the prejudices.
They've got different ones. Yeah. They're inventing new ones.
They'll invent new ones. Yeah. But it'll be good to see some of these old ones go away. And I think, you know, it's cool to see. You see it even what's happening in comedy. And a lot of the old guard of comedy is, you know, they're upset because it's changing. What you can and can't say changes. There are tweets. I used to say the word retard all the time. And when I lived in Maine, I used the word faggot prodigiously.
Yeah.
And I had friends who were gay and lesbian. I had trans friends. I used that because it was part of what we said.
Yeah.
And then when I moved and you meet other people and the generations that come up before, they're like, people are saying it bothers them, so don't do it anymore. And you can either listen and say, all right, I'm going to try to be better. I didn't mean anything by it. Because if you didn't mean anything by the word, if you didn't mean it as an insult, shouldn't be hard for you to discard then.
Yeah, throw it away. It's easy.
If faggot was never meant when I said it as a derogatory thing, I didn't think about it like that. I didn't associate it with that.
Yeah.
It just became a word that you would use for any number of things.
Yeah, everybody said that.
Yeah, and then you determine later on that people who are part of the LGBTQ community, it bothers them.
Yeah.
And they say it has a real effect on me. I didn't mean it. It wasn't what I was using it for. I'm not attached to it, so I won't say it.
Yeah.
Like, why is that such a big fucking deal? Like, we all did it. It's not a big fucking deal to just... Every comic used to wear sport coats on stage. You know what I mean? No one was sad to see that fucking go. No. You know what I mean? Like, like, people used to wear fucking all kinds of different clothes. Language is the same. Like, it goes through fads and things that it does. And the people who cling to it are the ones that you have to worry about.
Yeah.
Because it means something to them. It's a way to demean you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But there are those of us who did it in the past who just said it and didn't think about what we were saying when I said the word retard or when I said things like that. I didn't necessarily, it was insensitive. And you just didn't think that it bothered somebody.
Yeah.
And then when they say it, I'm like, I didn't mean it, so I just won't say it anymore. It's like, it doesn't make my life any better. I'm not using it to demean anybody. It's not a tool for me. So what do I care? I'm not using this tool so I can just chuck it aside.
Yeah.
And that's the difference. I think that that's what I hope people look at nowadays is if you dig far enough in any comic or anybody's past, and especially any white dude or white females past, you're going to find that we said some bad shit.
Well, yeah.
It's the people who are willing to change that.
We're the people who, you know, language can't touch us. You know what I mean? Language just can't, it can't touch you. As a straight white dude, or, you know, straight as straight goes.
Yeah, I'm going to have a piece
of
gum.
Yeah, yeah, have a piece of gum.
There was a weird pause because I was licking at him and I was like, can I have a piece of gum? And he was like, what are you doing?
Did you bring it up for the whole class?
You've got it. Okay, anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No. But think about it. Words can't hurt us. And so when you're a person who doesn't have that kind of, emotional intelligence to be able to look outside yourself and to go, well, words don't hurt me. Why should they hurt you?
Yeah.
It's because you've never been put in a situation where words have a meaning.
Right.
And not only do they have a meaning, usually they come with something.
Yeah.
And so I think that creating that education for people and trying to, you know, crack the nut of the emotional intelligence, I believe it's in everyone. Everyone's capable of empathy. It's just some people just won't bother with, you know, the guy who's like, well, you know, that guy's just an asshole, so I'm not going to bother.
Right. Or,
you know, that guy's a Republican. He's out of his mind. You know, I'm just not going to bother. Fuck that guy. I'm going to write him off.
Right.
But you can't always do that. And you shouldn't always do that.
Right.
And especially not when it's just over one thing.
Right.
You have to believe in the power of people to change. Otherwise, we should already be at war, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
people, there are people who are receptive to change, and then there are people who are afraid of it. And I think that that's it. There are just two different types of people. Everybody's willing to change.
But
everybody
you can have empathy for those people who are scared.
Yeah.
And you can go, I get that. I know why you're scared.
There are people in my family who, you know, and in my circle of friends, plenty of people who voted for Trump. And I've refused to get on the train of calling everybody who voted for him dumb. I refuse to be a part of that. It's not that. Do I like the
guy? I got
guy?
A few of those.
Do I like the Trump? No. I don't relate to billionaire land developers from New York. That's just not... Growing up in the punk scene, I never related to that. I would never... That's just not my people. I don't relate to the Clintons.
Yeah,
I don't relate
exactly.
to... That wealthy class of people are just not people I was ever around. Wealthy elite Democrats are not people that I was like around a lot. I was around more working class conservative people and grew up more around working class conservative people and people who went into the military. And those people were friends of mine.
Yeah.
They're people who helped me out. A lot of those people are afraid, and people go, well, they're afraid they're losing their dominance and things. Until you see how poor some of these areas get, that some of these areas are poverty stricken, that they feel like they've been thrown under the bus by a culture that's moving forward and leaving them behind when generations of them helped build this country.
Sure.
You know, and you can say whatever you, I mean, there's a lot of shit in the past. I'm just saying that's,
right.
it's not
but
as simple as.
How do you
as,
tell another, a whole other group of human beings that, you know, your time is over. And so we're all just waiting for you to die.
you
can't tell them that. And nor should you, you have to find a way to make them a part of the conversation.
There shouldn't
be them and us. There should just be us.
I think everybody has the same problem, which they just don't admit it. We all have a problem with globalism, with the cheap products, and it's everything cheap, and this ability, this idea that struck over us a little while ago. People talk about entitlement right now. They talk about entitlement as being only of the poor.
Yeah.
The poor feel like they're entitled to everything. No. The rich, the super wealthy feel like they're entitled. Not only are we the people who felt like that everything, we were the generation that felt like we deserved to have everything given to us, but we're also the generation that felt like we could drink as much from the water bottle and put it back in the fridge empty.
Yeah.
And not refill it for whoever came next.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. That is entitlement in itself. The idea that you should be able to get profoundly wealthy in this country and not pay your fucking fair share is killing more of us right now than any welfare class ever would. And we all have a problem with that. Everybody, black, white, Hispanic, Latino, it doesn't matter. Everybody has a problem with the fact that right now, they just don't know it.
Yeah.
That certain people believe that you have a right to amass wealth beyond a level that you would ever need.
Yeah.
And that you don't have to pay your part. I don't care that you get wealthy. Just pay the price for being that wealthy.
Sure.
Like, pay the cost for being that wealthy. I don't mind that. Like, I don't have a problem. I don't mind that you want to pay yourself an exorbitant amount of money. My thing has always been, we should set up ratio laws. It allows for consumerism. It allows for continued capitalism. But what it says is, if you're a CEO, You're not allowed to pay yourself any more than 20 times your lowest paid employee.
Yeah.
So if you want to pay yourself millions and millions of dollars a year, fine. You just have to pay the guy on the bottom more.
Yeah.
And I think
and it's a drop in the bucket.
It is. It's that thing that's killing us more. And I look at small towns like where I grew up in, and that killed them more.
Yeah.
It killed profits. Wall Street killed more families and jobs than anything. Taking textile mills away and moving them because it was cheaper to do because it benefits shareholders who are no longer the majority of the American public, but are now, most shares of stocks are held by hedge funds that are run by a few people.
Yeah.
And it's like no one's really pointing the finger at what is decimating this country,
and we're just watching it, and it's getting crazier and crazier,
and so we blame
bigger and bigger.
We blame, you know, like people who use welfare because they're getting poorer, more and more poor.
Yeah,
we're not paying anybody anymore. They need that assistance, so people on social assistance become the pariah of it. And to me, it's like you're not even like looking, the irony of you saying that and then turning around and espousing that your Walmart culture and that you love Walmart is insane to me. Those people closed your main street down.
Yes.
They're selling, they're feeding you your own remains and you're just okay with it. And I see it at everybody. I see the amount of hipsters that use Uber and Lyft right now on a regular basis, but talk about how they care about minorities. Really? Yeah. You do? You're stealing money from cab drivers because it's cheaper. You know, most cab companies are privately owned.
Yeah.
They're not owned by a piece of shit company like Uber that stuffs all its money offshore. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like everybody wants to blame something else for their problems.
Sure.
When you could just purchase things from people, you know what I mean? Buy from locally, buy from people, support cab drive, support those things around you.
Yeah, yeah.
And we probably would do a lot better as a culture. Mental health would do, there'd be a lot more revenue for this, but we cut things because there's just no money anymore, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, we're siphoning it up to the top of the triangle and everybody in the bottom is like, what the fuck do we do now? You know, like,
yeah,
I think it relates.
Well, it's like everything's falling apart. Nobody knows their place in the world anymore, because while the world is getting smaller, it's also becoming more and more big by the inclusion of the internet.
Yeah.
And so now, you know, what do you do? It's like, well, I guess I'll buy a new iPhone next year and then another one. And then maybe that'll make me happy.
Right.
Maybe then I'll know what's going on.
Yeah.
Maybe if I check into Facebook more often and find people who make me feel good about myself, I can start ignoring these things that are nagging at the back of my head.
Right.
Maybe that, while we just watch the slow decay.
Yeah. But I hope that our generation is witnessing all of this, the next generation.
And they are. I guarantee you they are.
And I think the best thing...
And they're going to fuck some things up too.
I think what's happening now is that people on both sides are hopefully teaching their kids to be passionate, to have a passion about something, you know, what I dislike is that I have friends from different groups, and that the minute, you know, politics comes up, the minute somebody knows your political affiliation, anything else you say gets thrown out.
Yeah.
You're immediately now, that's where we become. Everybody you just cast aside immediately.
Right.
Never mind that maybe you work, you know, at a nonprofit that helps kids, you know, like, or that guy that you don't like, that blue collar guy he's a welder at a water treatment plant. He keeps fresh water coming into your house.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Never mind that. You know, those...
That's a human being of value.
Yeah, there are valuable people on both sides. And what we've done is we've just whittled everything down to this reductionist viewpoint on each other. And it's making us sad.
Yeah.
And disconnected from the world. And it's not making anybody feel any better. And I wish I could just... I wish there was a way to just fix that, to slow it down. I saw a great documentary with... I can't remember her name, the documentarian. She was terrific. I just randomly turned it on. She She's an Indian woman, went in and infiltrated all kinds of like nationalist movements and actually sat down and like got them to let her like live with them. And by the end of it, like three people had left it because of how they felt she was treated and some of the emails she got.
Yeah.
And she had changed their position, not by posting. She just lived with them. And they were like, I like you. Yeah. You know what I mean? That does more good than anything else. If somebody likes you, you know, if they just, I just like them, you know, they're more apt to listen and to think, you know, on both sides next time. And I think that there's something that gets, I know with Milo, my son, he's just so isolated now.
Yeah.
But just, this culture is different. We're afraid of everybody around us.
Yeah.
And you don't let your kids out as much as you used to. And there's not, and rightfully so, you don't, there's a lot of things out there that we become aware of.
Like, well, the world has changed.
Yeah.
Ostensibly. So it's not just a matter of, you know, well, when I was a kid, my parents didn't know where I was until 2 days after it got dark. Yeah, I mean, that's cute, but the world was a different place then.
Mm-hmm.
And it has changed. And so the rules have changed.
Yeah.
And we're not entirely sure what they are.
Yeah.
So we're figuring it out. It's going to be a couple generations before you know, all of that.
Yeah, that's what I mean. We're on this weird cusp. Like this generation is, we're the generation that's clumsily trying to figure out this technological landscape that is advancing so rapidly.
Yeah.
And I think I saw this great documentary. This is one that I recommend everybody to see. It's called We Live in Public. And it was great. It was about that, this guy who created that experiment where he let a bunch of people live underground in New York City in this like thing. But the only caveat to it, he would feed them. It was like a 24-hour party. The only rule to it was you couldn't leave.
Yeah.
And that your lives were monitored on closed circuit television the entire time. And in your little pod sleeping bed, you could switch the channel and watch other people's pods.
Yeah.
And watch them showering and shit like that. And it was the first example of how humans react to being constantly monitored and to being constantly, to them constantly broadcasting themselves.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating. And he says it. He walks by the camera in the 80s. He walks by her in the early 90s. And he walks by, and at one point, he's with a group of people, and he just passingly says, in the future, you can use all our shit for free, but we own the images. And they paused it right there. And this guy predicted the future.
Oh, my God.
And it was like, in that moment, he said exactly what it is. Beware of anything that's free. Beware of Facebook. It's free.
Yeah.
It's free. When people were freaked out, and they were like, what? Facebook's selling our... You mean the giant multinational corporate conglomerate that's letting you pump in all your personal information, your location at any given time, all your likes, your birthday, all your friends, your social circle. You mean they're selling that information? Oh, God, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Like, of course they are. That's what they do.
And then, of course, I mean, at the beginning, it's, well, I mean, who gives a shit if somebody knows I like donuts? And that's the first thought.
Yeah.
But you don't see the far-reaching implications of that.
Until they discover that
somebody
donut
does
lovers
give a shit if you like donuts.
The donut lovers are most likely going to vote for this candidate.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? Like, it's a really interesting thing. And we got way out here.
Got way out here.
Yeah, but that's just what I do. And I'm tangential and random.
Let me ask you this then. So with all of this shit rattling around inside your head at any given time, so you're thinking about that, you're trying to be a good father. You're a sober guy now, who's decided to put that aside. And now you've got to figure out who you're going to be, how you're going to handle things. And you've still got a great big bucket of congratulations, anxiety and depression. How do you manage that in this day and age?
I mean, I had to come over some, I had to get over some things, some preconceived notions I had on I Got Demons, the first album. I talk about not taking medication, that I was trying to maintain my,
your edge.
my mental health with running and things like that and exercise. The problem is that mental illness can't be exercised away.
You can't outrun it.
Yeah. And I think I believed certain things, you know, doing the first and second season of Those Who Can't, and some of the stress that came along with that and family stuff, you know, I had a nervous breakdown about a year or a year and a half ago, and I just lost it. I had to cancel a bunch of shows, and it was the darkest place I'd been to as an adult. I mean, you know, when you put your toes over the edge and you stare like, could I end this all?
Yeah.
Kind of a thing. Or should I? And you start looking down that hole, it warps you a little bit. You know, I've not totally been right since then.
Yeah. Because now you have an option.
Yeah. And you know your brain is capable of dragging you down that road if things get stressful enough. And so finally I did succumb and I finally gave in. It was a good conversation with a psychiatrist who was like, you know, you're perpetuating the stigma that mental health and mental illness is just something people can wish away, you know, or can go out and have a good time and it'll just go away just by saying. She's like, you've tried that. That is a first line of defense. And I still believe that. I still believe a lot of people are overprescribed because they don't want to change their lifestyle. But I've eaten as healthy as I possibly can. I've worked out every day, sometimes twice a day. I've slept as much, you know, throughout a day as I'd been advised to. And my anxiety is still ubiquitous.
Yeah.
And it just came to a point where when I react poorly to stress, I shut down. And so I eventually just agreed to try meds. And I mean, it helped me immensely. Changed my life. I mean, it was kind of one of those things. The weaning onto it was terrible. I didn't like the sensation of taking any meds coming on. It's alien. Yeah, fuck, the vertigo. And like, I got these things called brain zaps, which were like, they're just like, kind of like I don't know how to describe it. Like,
no, I know exactly what you're
real quick
about.
Feeling of disorientation or a zap kind of. And, but once those went away, I remember I didn't feel any different. I remember the day it changed. I was at breakfast with my wife. It was just my wife and I sitting there having breakfast, and we were talking and talking, and about an hour had gone by, and she stopped and she was like, you haven't tried to get up and leave. And I was like, oh my God, you're right. I literally was not thinking about it. I was like, it's just quieter. My anxiety is just quieter.
Yep.
All of a sudden I could fly on a plane again. I could be on a plane again. I wasn't walking away from flights, which I would do. I would walk to the jetway and turn around and run, you know, and then find myself in the corner of an airport just fucking sobbing. And my emotions weren't like controlling me as much. And it was definitely a leg up that I needed. And so it changed my perception of that. I tell everybody, I think you should look at your lifestyle. You know, if you're smoking, if you're drinking a lot, those are going to make your anxiety and depression far worse.
Yeah.
You should probably, before you start taking SSRIs or benzos or anything like that, probably try changing your eating and your like lifestyle habits first. You know, exercise does still work. It does help me out a lot.
Exercise is great.
It's great. Jiu-jitsu, I don't talk about it a lot on stage, and I don't talk about it a lot because it's important to me. But jiu-jitsu changed my life. I mean, I don't know what those, like, the Japanese and the Brazilians figured out, but I mean, I call it yoga with consequences. It's sort of what it is. It's like,
yeah,
yoga, I would try yoga, but I would days off. And if I lost the pose, who fucking cares?
Yeah.
But in jiu-jitsu, there's real consequences. Lapses in judgment lead to you being choked the fuck out. So,
yeah.
And it gave me that same focusing on a minutia of something. Takes you out of your brain for 2 hours. And when you come back, it's just quieter. It's just better. I'm more relaxed. It got those endorphins and that dopamine going, and plus it brought out a side of me that I didn't think was there. I wasn't an athletic kid, and I always see myself as fat because I was a heavy kid, and
I think it helped my self-image a lot. You know, I realized, like, I am kind of an athletic dude. I'm not the best at this, but I can hold my own. And, like, yeah. And I've discovered an athletic side to me. That's the only part that ever impedes me in jiu-jitsu is still my mind.
Right.
My body can do all of it, but sometimes I get stuck in, like, fat kid syndrome where I'm like, I lay on my back and I'm like, I'm being beat up, you know what I mean? But it's helped me work through a lot of that. And I think
there's something great about getting your body to obey a command from your head.
Yeah.
And seeing a physical change in yourself, because once you start seeing results from effort, it teaches you that success is possible.
Yeah.
And that your ability to control your own destiny forward is at least possible.
Yeah. We feel a lot like, I think all of us feel like we're bouncing, like that we don't have choices. We're just always reacting to the same stimuli. We're always like, I've got to do this. And, you know, and I definitely think when you find something that changes your perception of yourself, you realize that this world is completely malleable. You can warp it. You know, it can be changed. If you can change yourself and your outlook on yourself, then it seems like I can change the environment around me and the people who I associate with and the work that I do and try to change. But it definitely starts at the beginning with you. And I think that that's what jiu-jitsu has always been, that rock for me. It's always been a rock. Like, it's like, since I started it, it's the thing that when life is chaotic and I feel out of myself. Now, my wife, who was not because of the injuries at first and stuff, was like, why are you doing this? But now she's the first one when I'm like in a shit mood or seem like down on myself to be like, go to jiu-jitsu. Just get out of here and go to class, you know? And getting the dog shit beat out of you by fucking monsters. Like some 19-year-old kid who's training for the IBJJF Worlds or something like that, just knocking you around on the mat, and at the end you're like, I love it. I'm Sparta. You know, I got choked out like 10 times, but I still feel like I'm a fucking champion. I tell everybody that. I wish more.
Well, beats the hell out of choking yourself out.
Tell that to the guy from NXS, huh? But it's. I think, like,
well, it was a new sensation.
Hey, but I don't even think that actually happened to him. I think that's urban legend. But
no, I think he did it. It was him and David Carradine. They both just decided, you know,
what a way to
let's
go,
grab
though.
Some lemons
go.
And do this.
But I think I talked to my psychiatrist about, and you know, about how I would love. I think jiu-jitsu and I think martial arts have an incredible ability, especially with people who experience sexual abuse or abuse, to empower them. And I wish more people would do that. I understand why they don't.
Do you think it's because of the physical aspect of it?
Oh yeah, definitely. And I also think it's a tough group of people to be around. I mean, right now, sure. MMA and jiu-jitsu and Muay Thai is, you know, I mean, a lot of tough people do that. And I think it's an embarrassing environment to, I know that there are people who are going to have emotion if somebody is, you know, if you're working on defending a choke. If you've been victimized, it's going to scare the fuck out of you.
Yeah.
And so
immersion therapy.
Right. I
one
think
way to look at it, I guess.
I think empowering people, and I think having the right instructors. I think if there are female instructors out there who started classes specifically, who maybe have experienced something like that in the past and are sensitive to the emotions that will come up in women or in people or men who are victims or whoever. I think that feeling like you can defend yourself, that you're able to stand up for yourself physically, is a very powerful tool. I think a lot of times it's dismissed, but feeling like you can stand your ground physically allows you emotionally and mentally to be able to be more resolute in who you are.
Yeah.
And I think, like, I really, like, would recommend that to anybody out there, that if you find the right people and the right safe environment for you to train at and to learn to sharpen yourself, to make yourself, like, to find that weapon within yourself. And I truly believe that. Doesn't mean you have to be used for negative, But sure, the ability to defend yourself physically. I know I got pushed into so much shit that I struggle with nowadays because I was afraid physically to stand up for myself.
Yeah.
And I think adults are the same way. We leave that to kids. You know, we put kids in karate class. How many adults need to learn to feel physically assertive, like to stand, hold their chin high and be like, no, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
I'm not going to let you talk to me like that. I'm not going to let you put me in this position at work. I'm not going to do that. We're all afraid of physical reprisal. Everybody is.
Yeah.
And if you can learn to master that fear, if you can learn to conquer that and at least feel like, if it comes to blows, I know I have something on my side.
Yeah.
You feel more confident to say, I don't like this. I don't want to do this. And I think that that gives you power back. It gives that kid in your past power back, or that teenage girl that was victimized, or whoever, gives you that power back to stand up for them, you know? So I think if I could leave anything with that, that's what I would say. I would say, like, you know, finding a way to, it's been invaluable for me to, like, finding a way to empower myself, you know, physically is, you know, something. And I'd probably get my ass kicked. People will be like, oh, it's, and then they'll see me sometime outside of a bar just getting the dog shit knocked out of me. But
there's value in being able to take a punch.
Yeah.
It really is.
We should end it with that. There's value in being able to take a punch. Hey, guys, thanks so much for tuning in. No, but I agree. I think there's that. I hope more people go out and find that in some manner, whether it's, you know, some way to, if in the past you dealt with that, to find a way to find your voice. It may not even be with, maybe it's assertive speaking, like public speaking, you know, like it's the same thing. Being confident in your message is something that people need to learn, you know, and to stand up to family or anybody, you know?
Yeah. Well, thanks for talking to me, man.
Dude, this was really good. We like blew through time.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry I was all over the place.
Oh, it's fine. Well, he was not wrong. That definitely went all over the place. And I'm so glad that it did. This was an amazing interview. What do you think, guys? Go out and get yourself some of that sweet, sweet rock and roll. You can check out his band at spellsrules.com. You can also go to truetv.com/thosewhocan't for information on the TV show. And he's got 2 albums on iTunes. Go check them out. That's it for this week, everybody. I've been all over the place myself, and I got a lot of stuff brewing on the back end. I promise I haven't forgotten about you. How could I? I love you too much. Don't kill yourselves out there.